put a lot into the blood sugar, a lot of different ways to analyze it, but I also snuck in a few helpful hints on how to manage it as well. Again, this is something I say at the beginning of all my presentations, and I encourage you to do the same as you're working with people and presenting, whether it's one-on-one or in a formal presentation. Some way of saying, I'm not diagnosing you. This isn't medical advice. This is education. I'm educating you about how your body works so that you can make really amazing decisions about how to take care of it. But if you are on any medication, if you are under the care of a medical practitioner, make sure that any changes you make to your diet and lifestyle are in conjunction with that practitioner. Now, we all know that we have patients that do not have a medical practitioner and don't want to have a medical practitioner because they don't want interventions in the medical and surgical realm. That's fine. And that's their decision. But you still have to tell them that you're not diagnosing them and that they need to work with their medical practitioner. It's just, you know, where it goes. You may be able to help them solve all their problems without it, but if they are on medication or under the care, just to cover yourself, you should be telling people. So we think about the regular blood test, without the extra goodies, right? Glucose is the big one. You look at fasting glucose, and people think, oh, it's a good indicator for diabetes. Wrong. Totally not. So, because why? Because the fasting glucose is one of the last things to go. So if you're really looking to rule out diabetes or insulin resistance, you need to be looking at the fasting glucose. But if it's normal, you also want to look at the triglycerides. Ideally, it's between 50 and 100, but more importantly, the triglycerides need to be in a proper ratio with HDL. In fact, the triglyceride-HDL ratio should be 1. And if you look through some old labs of your own or you look through some people, it's really hard to find. Most people who are having trouble with their weight, who are having trouble with glucose fluctuations, have any health issues, fatigue, you're going to find that their triglycerides are higher than their HDLs. But we want the triglycerides and the HDLs to be right about the same, triglyceride-HDL ratio. The other thing is insulin. It's not measured a lot, but I think it's a really important test. You want your fasting insulin to be between 2 and 5. If your fasting insulin is higher than that, that's suggestive of hyperinsulinemia. Your body's making too much insulin. It's a direct predecessor to insulin resistance, then metabolic syndrome, and then on the way to diabetes, and the predisposition for heart disease, high blood pressure, and cancer. So blood sugar regulation is super, super, super important. It's so important that I have a whole course devoted to that. And we just announced it. We have a whole bunch of people starting in it. And it's called Before Be Gone. We also have a course for practitioners called the Insulin Resistance Solution Practitioner Training, where we teach practitioners how to really be astute in dealing with their people with blood sugar problems. So it's not something I can teach in 20 minutes. It's something that I actually taught in many hours, and we had a seminar just like this as part of that program, which is a whole day's worth of how to deal with insulin resistance. So these are some of the basics. If glucose is above the optimal range, you want to look at hemoglobin A1C, get a glucose meter. If glucose is above the optimal range, or if people are showing signs of insulin resistance, and we'll show you what some of those are, then you should be getting hemoglobin A1C. But personally, I think anybody who has excess belly fat, especially somebody who's thin with excess belly fat, because then it's really clear that that's excess belly fat, not just general obesity, then fatigue, adrenal burnout, brain fog, depression, difficulty focusing, I would run a hemoglobin A1C because you want to see what that is. I also encourage people to do a glucose meter, and I actually teach all the people, the students that take my Before Be Gone program, learn how to do their own glucoses. They become masters at doing it, and they become so in control of what they eat and their blood sugars because they know how to do it and they manage it at home by themselves. You know, and some people say, well, why are you teaching people how to do all this? It's going to put you out of business. And I'm like, yep, that's what I want. My goal for this world is that everybody knows just what they need to know to take care of themselves, and they don't need me anymore. That's my goal. If your fasting glucose is high and your hemoglobin A1C is normal, it could be a B1 deficiency. So this is something to look at. If your fasting glucose is high, so they run the test, their fasting glucose is 95. You run the hemoglobin A1C and it's 4.8. You're going, huh, the glucose is high, but they could have a B1 deficiency that's driving up that fasting glucose. Okay? So also some of those other things that you might see, if it's a vitamin B1 deficiency, they may also have a carbon dioxide of less than 25, which is in the acid range. So that's the acidosis range. And LDH, liver enzyme we're going to talk about shortly, less than 140. Okay? So that's the basic one. So let's look at hemoglobin A1C. So hemoglobin A1C, an indirect measure of your blood sugars over a 120-day period. That's the life of a blood cell. When there's any glucose in your blood, there a certain percentage of your hemoglobin gets glycosylated. Hemoglobin A1C is a measure of the glycosylated hemoglobin. So what does that mean? That's a fancy word for saying my hemoglobin is covered with sugar. And the number that you get for this test is a percentage. What percentage of your hemoglobin or your red blood cells are coated? Now, you may think, well, now what's the big deal about sugar-coated blood cells? Well, they get stiff. Do you ever like to leave molasses or honey or something out on the table and it stiffens up? That happens in your system, and the coating causes the edges of those blood cells, instead of being nice and smooth, to be a little raggedy, have little jagged edges, which can damage the cell lining, the cell walls, of the inner parts of your blood vessels. So it's an indirect measure. It measures the amount, the percentage of the blood cells that have this hemoglobin, this glycosylated coating, and it's irreversible. Once your blood cells get coated, it doesn't go away. So the way that you measure this, you have to wait 120 days if you're making changes before you see it. And the numbers that are considered normal and the numbers that are considered safe, there's some really strange logic going on there. The optimal range is actually 4.5 to 5. And what that is, what that measures out to, is an estimated average glucose of somewhere in the neighborhood of 90-ish. You may say, well, that's a little high, isn't it? Well, it's fine because you're averaging. It's the average. So while you're sleeping and you're at fasting level of maybe 80, and then after eating it goes up, when it averages out to somewhere around 90, you're in good shape. You've never had those really high sugar spikes. So optimal range, 4.5 to 5. Now, let me tell you what they say for diabetics. For a diabetic is considered under control if their hemoglobin A1C is 7 or less. Okay. So they're still at 7 or less. The average estimated glucose is somewhere in the range of a 135 to 140. That's the average. That's considered under control. Now, if it's going down while they're sleeping, it means that there's times when it's going up really high. And I want to share just two little tidbits that I share with people in the insulin resistance program. One, every single time your glucose goes up to above 120, it causes damage to the peripheral nerves. The peripheral neuropathies that diabetics get do not suddenly come on once they've turned the corner and become diabetic. They've been in this state of out-of-control glucose for many, 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 many years before they actually get diagnosed. And that the changes, that the neuropathies, the damage to the nerves and the vessels has been happening for many, many years leading up to that. So every time you, like, eat some sugar and it shoots your sugar up above 120, you're causing damage to your peripheral nerves. Every time it goes above 140, it's actually doing damage to the retina. And diabetic retinopathy is another one of those side effects that affects diabetics. But that's been building for many, many, many years. That's why I like people to keep within 4.5 to 5. The range that's on the lab reports, they'll say up to 5.6 or 5.7. Okay? But even at 5.3, your average hemoglobin is like 105 or 110, which means that there are times you're most likely going above 120 at times throughout the day, which is not a good thing. When somebody is hypoglycemic, which is rare, most people are reactive hypoglycemic, which means they are going back and forth between high sugar and low. But in somebody who's a true hypoglycemic or hemolytic anemia or blood loss or pregnancy, you can actually get lower numbers. So if it's below that 4.5, I'd be checking into some of those things. Rare, very rare. So I just want to give you a little update on these blood sugar imbalance conditions. Hypoglycemia is considered low blood sugar. And generally, hypoglycemia is not pure hypoglycemia. It's what's called reactive hypoglycemia, meaning your sugar goes way up, you overproduce insulin, and your sugar drops way down. And that's a reactive hypoglycemia. So you're back and forth all day long. And that person that's hypoglycemic is usually hyperinsulinemic. That means their insulin levels are going up too high. Next stage would be insulin resistance. You've been in that reactive hypoglycemia state, hyperinsulinemic, for quite a while, and your cells develop resistance to the insulin, and you develop insulin resistance, which has a lot of side effects. I'll show you that chart, the exact numbers that are considered. But insulin resistance is a precursor to diabetes. Usually it's a precursor to something called metabolic syndrome, which is like a more pronounced insulin resistance with some pathological changes to lipids and cardiovascular system, like hypertension, high cholesterol, high triglycerides. And then with diabetes, you have type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is an autoimmune disease that affects the islets of Langerhans in your pancreas, which produce it, or it affects the insulin itself. Some people produce antibodies to insulin. And those are all things you can test. They're special tests. And then the type 2 diabetes, which is insulin resistance, severe insulin resistance to the point where you're not able to get sugar into your cells at all, and then it can go the way of making not enough insulin because your pancreas gets burned out. And it's hard to tell which state a person's in without measuring their insulin. So quick in on insulin resistance, high glucose greater than 100 but less than 120. Hemoglobin A1C might be elevated, but sometimes it's not that high in insulin resistance or early insulin resistance. But if it's above, I even think above 5.0, 5.3, you would consider that person insulin resistant. Their fasting insulin tends to go above 5. They have increased weight around the waist. That's the classic for insulin resistance. The waist-hip ratio is either greater than or equal to 1 in a male, meaning that their waist is at the same size or larger than their hips, or if their waist is just overall more than 40 inches, they're considered at risk of insulin resistance. Or in women, it's the waist-hip ratio is greater than or equal to 0.8, right? Or the waist size is bigger than 35 inches. Metabolic syndrome, like I said, is like, you know, insulin resistance on steroids. Because the changes in insulin resistance have been going on for so long, you have an increased risk of cardiovascular. But here's what the labs look like. You see triglycerides greater than 110 or 1.24 on the international scale. The total cholesterol is greater than 220, which equates to 5.69 on the international scale. The HDLs are less than 55. The glucose is greater than 100. These are the classic signs of metabolic syndrome. The hemoglobin A1C, the fasting insulin is greater than 5. They usually have high blood pressure, and that's a result of the changes that that high level of insulin makes on the inside of the vessel walls. It makes them very inelastic. And the hemoglobin A1C definitely greater than 5.7. So when somebody crosses the line between very early insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, it's usually related to the lipid numbers and the blood pressure. Same thing with the increased weight around the waist. So assessment of diabetes then is the glucose goes high above 120 on two tests. It used to be above 140, and now they're bringing it. They're saying 120. Hemoglobin A1C is greater than 6.5. That used to be 7, but now this study here was instrumental at lowering that down to 6.5. The triglycerides are usually greater than 110, not always. Cholesterol greater than 220, but not always. Usually the HDLs are low at 55 or less, and the blood pressure is usually increased. So that's diabetic. But the way that, you know, technically, if you go by the diagnostic criteria, is the glucose greater than 120 on two tests and hemoglobin A1C above 6.5. Going to really quickly, most of you have heard this before, so I'll just review it because it's important as we look at some of the labs. After a meal, the increased glucose, amino acids, the stuff that's in your blood after you eat, causes your pancreas to secrete insulin, which binds to the cell membrane and then triggers the glucose receptors in the cell membrane. And when it triggers it, it opens up the channels and allows glucose, amino acids, fats, magnesium, and other nutrients to get inside the cell, where it can be utilized by the cell for energy. Once the nutrients are cleared from the blood, your pancreas says, oh, great, I don't have to produce any more insulin. But what happens in insulin resistance is that it doesn't get that signal anymore. So as a result of insulin binding to a cell, several things happen. It triggers the preferential use of glucose over fat as fuel and inhibits the fat burning by the cells. Insulin inhibits fat burning. Insulin inhibits fat burning. And people have to hear that over and over again. You've got to repeat that with people. Whenever they've got insulin going on, it inhibits the burning of fat. It inhibits growth hormone. Well, what does growth hormone do? Growth hormone helps you burn fat and put down lean. Growth hormone helps you repair. It's your friend. So when insulin is bound to the cell, it inhibits burning of fat and growth hormone. It even slightly depresses thyroid by blunting the conversion of T4 to T3. And you'll understand more what that is when we finish the thyroid section. So you got a lot of changes that happen when insulin comes out. And as a result of insulin resistance, either the circulating insulin doesn't bind to the insulin receptors on the cell, or it binds, but its effects are deficient. And then the nutrients and the glucose are not cleared efficiently from your blood. They sit in the blood. And what does that do? It triggers the pancreas to produce more insulin. And you get lots and lots of insulin. And it's when that's been happening for a while that the insulin causes damage to the cell walls, the cells inside your blood cells. The blood vessel linings do not get insulin resistance. They just develop problems from having too much insulin in there. Okay? And it takes a long time. So you've got insulin in your system for a long time. And remember we just said that when insulin is in your system, you can't burn fat. So for your people you're working with who are trying to get rid of the excess belly fat or just trying to get to their ideal weight, and they're eating every 2 or 3 hours, what does that do to their efforts? It thwarts them. You should be going 4 to 6 hours between meals. You want to allow the insulin levels to come back down, allow growth hormone levels to rise, and allow fat burning to happen beautifully. And when this happens, when you get insulin resistance, those insulin resistant cells, like say your liver, your organs, your glands, and your untrained muscle. So again, the negative effects of insulin resistance, and I'm harping on this because it's such a dramatic problem, and you're going to see a lot of people who are not going to come to you and say, I have insulin resistance, can you fix me? They're going to come to you with a lot of problems. And when you get their blood sugars managed, you get their immune system working better, you get their digestion working better, you get them overall working much better. So what happens as a result of insulin resistance is the cells that are resistant don't get enough energy, and so they become deficient. They become sluggish. Maybe your thyroid becomes sluggish. Maybe your liver becomes sluggish and toxins build up. Your bowel may become sluggish and you have constipation. Your brain may become sluggish and you feel depressed. And you can't think straight That's where the brain fog comes from. You have excess anabolic effects, increased body fat, especially around the middle, right? It's storing fat, not burning. You have oxidative processes that happen in the non-insulin resistant cells, like the linings of your blood vessels. They're exposed to too much insulin, and insulin damages them, causes them to become less elastic, stiffer, which isn't make for good cardiovascular function, especially when you're going to exercise and put a little bit of a load on it. You do get systemic inflammation because you get elevated inflammatory markers from insulin. Hypertension, the thick blood, your blood gets thicker as a result of insulin resistance. You retain water. And then you have whatever effects, the long-term systemic effects of low growth hormone, which means you're not laying down new lean muscle. You're not helping to repair things that need to be repaired. And then, of course, thyroid, which affects your metabolism. So insulin resistance can cause your thyroid to slow down, your metabolism to slow down. What causes insulin resistance? You could be genetic. In fact, by age 60, 40% of Americans have at least three markers, and 60 to 70% have at least one. It's epidemic. Omega-3 deficiency, like DHEA. Too much omega-6, and you know that when people eat too much corn oil and a lot of the vegetable fats that people are pushing, they are getting too much omega-6, and when you get that ratio, you can create insulin resistance by damaging the cell membranes. Deficiencies of minerals like chromium and magnesium and zinc, and deficiencies of your B vitamins. And it's possibly thought that boron and lithium play a role. Lack of resistance exercises. You know, you see it all the time, right? People are sitting at desk jobs. They're not out there working. You got to get them working because you lose muscle mass, and the trained muscle mass is not insulin resistant. It doesn't become insulin resistant, but it's the untrained muscle that does. Of course, it's the intake of all the sugars and the processed foods and the starches, even fruit juices, fresh squeezed, and sodas, because fruit juices fresh squeezed are without the starch, and it can cause spiking. Stress causes your cortisol to go up, which causes you to produce more sugar. I tell people, getting stressed is like eating a candy bar without the fun of the candy bar. It causes that much of an elevation in your blood sugar. And I've seen it and measured it with people. I've watched friends go crazy because they've lost their keys or something, and I just say, can I just take your blood sugar? I'd like to see what it is right now. And the blood sugar goes way up as a result of stress, which is not good for you. You develop insulin resistance. And then if you don't have enough protein or you have bad protein absorption, remember we talked earlier about how stomach acid, we don't absorb our protein. That can cause insulin resistance as well. So I recommend, you know, this is a blood chemistry. You can test your own blood chemistry with a glucose meter and a hemoglobin A1C. You can actually test at home. It's a little trickier, so you don't want to recommend that to people who are a little bit spaced out and ditzy about things because it's a little trickier, but the glucose meter is easy to do. The hemoglobin A1C requires some timing and some specific measures and things. You can teach them how to do a home glucose tolerance test. It usually costs hundreds of dollars to go into the office, the doctor's office, and get this done. They measure your fasting glucose, and then they give you sugar water, and then they measure your glucose at prescribed times thereafter. You can have them do it at home. You can just have them eat a test meal. You don't have to do it with sugar. You get to see how they react to their own ones. And we teach all about how to do this in the insulin resistance course. But as far as your glucose tolerance test, your maximum should be 110. When you look at the charts of when they've done these, you have a group of people who never get above 110, even when they drank the glucose solution. Those people have awesome glucose control, and that's what you want to be striving for. Ideally, the peak is between 99 and 100, and the blood sugar never drops below the starting point because that means that they're having reactive hypoglycemia, producing too much insulin and then crashing. Consequences are cardiovascular disease. We've already talked that because of the effects on the triglycerides and the synthesis of cholesterol. It also affects coagulation. Like I said, it thickens the blood and lowers your HDL, which is your scavenger that goes around and takes the used up cholesterol out of your system for you. causes hypertension, which is high blood pressure, weight loss resistance, and insulin resistance contributes to leptin resistance. And we don't have time to go into all the mechanisms right now because I want to move on to the thyroid, but I just wanted to give you some exposure to this. It can cause fatty liver, impaired detoxification. It can lead to androgen dominance. I just consulted with someone last week about her 12-year-old daughter who has PCOS, androgen dominance. You know, the facial hair and the no periods and all the things that show that she's got, plus the cysts on her ovaries. Insulin resistance leads to PCOS. And if you're working with anybody with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, then you want to make sure that you talk to them about being on a low glycemic diet and working on insulin resistance. It affects phase 2 detoxification. It can cause all kinds of cancers. So just as a summary, the medications that hinder the stuff, because you're going to be talking to people, they're going to be on medications, and it may be something as simple as their medication is what's causing it. So on the left-hand side is hyperglycemia. Those are the medications that are affecting it, corticosteroids, anti-seizure meds, birth control, and thiazide diuretics. And things that cause hypoglycemia are alcohol, obviously insulin, because that's what it does, certain hypertension medicine called propranolol, and also oral diabetes medications, obviously, because that's what they're intended for. But it's good to know these things. And the last thing I'm going to leave you with is you got to get people off gluten if you want them to help themselves with diabetes, prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, or insulin resistance. Type 1 diabetics, they definitely have loss of the islet cell due to autoimmune attack. And all people with type 1 should be on a gluten-free diet until you prove otherwise. And children of type 1 should. But well, you're saying, well, I don't see that many people with type 1. It's usually type 2. What you're going to find is that you're going to see people coming into their office that you don't think are type 2 diabetic. They've been told they're type 2 diabetic, but there's just some things that don't fit. And I had a guy like that last summer, and he just didn't fit. I said, I don't think you have type 2 diabetes. He goes, what do you mean? I've been diagnosed. I'm on this medication, but I want to get off. I don't want to go on insulin. They want to put me on insulin. I said, well, let's do some tests. So we ran some autoimmune tests, and we looked for something called LADA, latent adult onset diabetes of autoimmune origin. And sure enough, he had it. He had antibodies to his insulin. So every time he was making insulin, he was gonking it out. He had antibodies to he didn't have it to the pancreas cells, but there were two others, and I don't recall which ones he had, but there are markers that you do for a panel to see if somebody has this adult onset. And sure enough, you can treat it differently. I got him off gluten and dairy big time, and I got him on to some supplements, and his hemoglobin A1C dropped from 11 to about 7 in the course of 6 weeks, which is really unheard of. I didn't want him to redo it at 6 weeks, but he did. He wanted to. It's very important to run tests, yes. It's very important. That's why we're here. Absolutely. And just as an aside, in gluten testing, we will go into that in our digestive module, all about how to do that. The way that the average medical doctor tests for it is to run a celiac panel, which will look for transglutaminase and antibodies and anti-gliadin. They look for one fraction of the anti-gliadin. There's actually 20. So it's not very accurate, and they miss a lot. There's two other ways you can do it. You can have a stool test for an IgA antibody, which is what lines your gut, and you can also do a test through C-Rex Labs, which tests the blood, but they test for 20 different fractions and subfractions. There's also a genetic marker, and we'll talk more about that when we do our genomics test lab. So blood sugar case, let's look at this case. So this person comes back with a glucose of 74. It may or may not be a problem. Their TSH is 7.17. Now, we haven't gone through that yet, so you don't realize how high that is, but 1.8 to 3, 7.7 is pretty darn high. They have a free T4 of 1.227, which is within the range. They have a free T3, which is significantly under the ideal range. So what this is saying to me, and their LDH is high. Now, remember, we said with a hypoglycemic number, a low glucose number, and an LDH high, right? What was that indicative of? Does anybody remember? So this person has some hypoglycemic tendencies. There's some thyroid stuff going on here that needs to be checked out. We'll get more of that when we do our next section. But her free T3 is low, which says to me that she's not converting. This might be a deficiency of iodine or selenium are the most common ones, and an excess of stress, an excess of cortisol, right? So you don't have enough here to go on, but this one is a hypoglycemic kind of a presentation.